And Bhagavad Gita was spoken about 5,000 years ago. Now that's not something that would go down very easily if we went to the nearest university in the Indology department. But Mahabharata does have certain empiric evidence to confirm that, namely that there are astrological calculations to tell exactly when the Mahabharata war took place, which is only 18 days long. And that goes back to around 3,100 and something BC, so it's a little 5,000 years ago. And that is the stellar constellations. There's actually a few of those in the Mahabharata that discusses the timing, so it gives us actually a... And it's not something that's taken on faith, it's just astrology will tell you that it happens at that particular time. So it's considered to be very ancient literature, and the language of the Bhagavad Gita is to actually instruct us and guide us into understanding ourselves. The Bhagavad Gita itself is divided into 18 chapters, as I mentioned, of 700 verses, and it has three main portions, according to three main different types of yoga that are being emphasized. The first six chapters talks about karma, or karma yoga. Karma yoga means connecting. Once again, yoga means to connect. Connecting through one's work. Not actually the work itself, but actually making a connection or connecting with the Supreme by giving up the results of our work, or working without attachment. So in Sanskrit it's called sarva karma phala tyagam. Tyaga means to give up. We all work. Everyone has to work. We all work in this world. Otherwise we can't maintain ourselves. So Krishna explains like that, that everyone has to work in order to maintain themselves. And of course Krishna is the speaker of the Bhagavad Gita. But there's a spirit in which one is meant to be working with. And that spirit is called tyag, or it's called detachment. A spirit of detachment. What's detachment? Detachment is that one is not concerned with the results of one's work, but one works according to duty. And then according to the basis of whatever one's the result of one's work is, one lives accordingly. Now that's a little different than our consumer society and our consumer way of life, where everyone is measured by performance and is meant to be performance-oriented and not low performance, but high performance. And if you underperform, then it's not a good thing. It's looked at as some type of weakness, and you're meant to actually maintain. Our whole society is based upon that. That's why we're having so much financial problems, because it's actually a catch-22 situation. Ultimately, you can't just perform, and it just keeps on growing endlessly. There's no such thing as endless gains, because there's no endless supply. There's a finite supply. But we are sort of led to believe that we can continue just increasing our standard of living ad infinitum by consuming, buying, selling, working hard. But our resources are not increasing proportionately. In fact, they're not increasing at all. They're fixed. We've got a globe. It's this big. It's 25,000 miles in circumference, and that's as big as it's going to get. It's not going to grow any bigger. So what we see is what we got, and it's an illusion to think that we live otherwise. So karma yoga is meant to cultivate that type of consciousness, that type of dutiful acceptance of the fact that we have to work within the limits that the world has given us. There are limits. Can everyone in the world live at the same standard as a New Yorker? It's not possible. You cannot feed 6.7 billion people or maintain them at that standard of living. To do so, you need, right now, you would need six planets to provide that type of resources. Of course, everyone else is thinking that they're going to live like that. But it's an illusion. It's not possible. So, but still, our society is a hedonistic one, and it goes in that direction. And unless we learn how to actually control our motivation and our spirit of work, we're heading into destruction. We're going to destroy ourselves. We're destroying our planet. I mean, that's not news. So our water is undrinkable. Our food, it doesn't matter. You close your eyes, whether it's a cabbage or an apple, it all tastes the same. And it all has the same food content. So it's just, and it's costing more and more and more because everything that we eat happens to be connected with some black stuff that comes out of the ground called oil or petroleum for some unimaginable reason. Because if you pour petroleum on a cabbage, it won't grow. Even cabbage won't grow, although cabbage can grow practically under any circumstances. So, but our food is connected to this oil that's being pumped out of the earth. And as that price goes up, then the price of our food goes up. But anyway, that's another topic, but it's not unrelated. It's related to the fact that unless we actually practice karma yoga, unless we are satisfied with the results of our work and we realize that we only have actually so many resources in our local geographical area, and on the basis of that, we're satisfied with what we get. And we live in that sort of spirit of detachment. So the first six chapters of Bhagavad Gita are about that. The middle six chapters are actually the essential portion of Bhagavad Gita. It talks about bhakti, or it talks about devotion. Devotion means that aspect of yoga which may be present in all different types of yoga systems where one actually devotes himself to the Supreme. In other words, when one becomes surrendered. And this whole concept of surrender is summarized at the end of the Bhagavad Gita. For instance, the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita talks about Hatha Yoga. Hatha Yoga and Ashtanga Yoga come under the category of Karma Yoga. And it leads into the subsequent chapters, seventh chapter, which talks about bhakti. And the whole idea being is that whether you perform karma, hatha yoga, jnana yoga, these are the three main branches, general branches of yoga, and then there are so many names of different types of yogas, they all fall under these three. The essence of all of them, or the mood of all of them, is ultimately they're meant to actually bring us to a certain spirit or a mood of surrender. Surrender means that we accept our subordination to the Supreme and we act as a servant as in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna then establishes himself as that Supreme or as that Supreme Lord. So that is bhakti. Bhakti is really the spirit or the mood of surrender, which is not something that you can achieve by working. It's not something that comes out of a sense of duty. It's not something that comes by breathing exercises. Neither does it come by the last six parts of the Bhagavad Gita, which is called Jnana Yoga, or metaphysics, or sometimes we may call it philosophical speculation, trying to understand what makes the world around us work, why it works. There's a very interesting type of metaphysics that's practiced by certain yogis, for instance, in India. They practice a certain type of meditation whereby they can actually penetrate down to the level of the atom. Now, modern nuclear physicists, they're also trying to actually study what is the smallest particle? Is it an electron, an atom, a quark, a neutron? And how do these things work? And why do they work? This type of study, which they do, and now they build this whole burn reactor, it's called, that big thing in Switzerland, France. That's right, that goes around at billions and billions of pounds of expense. That same type of experiment can be done through meditation. And there are different schools, there are particularly two different schools of yogis who cultivate that type of meditation. I'm just giving that as an example of what meditation can do, and it allows one to actually study the very, very essential nature of matter. Unfortunately, of course, that meditation is also material, because the cause of existence, the cause of the world, our cause, is not just matter. It's not just atoms and electrons. And by a mechanical system of meditation, which is in itself material, you can only come to a material system of cause and effect. But they try to study also the cause and effect that modern science is really diligently pursuing by the system of meditation. So Jnana Yoga is, what is the world? How does it work? What are the different elements that make the world work? And why? What is actually the real energies that cause things to exist? For instance, astrophysicists tell us that, you know, when they look out into the sky outside, that they see the stars and the galaxies and everything. And unfortunately, what they see only accounts for 10% of what they surmise is actually out there. In other words, the universe, by calculation, should be 10 times heavier than what it is that they're actually seeing. What they see doesn't add up to what exists. Where is the rest of creation that they can infer, they understand that exists, but they can't determine by any type of sensual perception? So this is the type of questioning that someone may also do either by telescopes or instruments, or they can also just use their intellect, meditation, and also this type of metaphysical research to try to understand. But once again, one comes to what? One comes to this real question, original question, where does everything come from? What is the cause of everything? We may say that it's a Big Bang, but then we're still left with the problem of where does the bang come from? So what caused the Big Bang? Or if you talk about a primordial soup, then where did the primordial soup come from? Or if it was just some original elements, where did the elements come from? Well, there has to be some kind of causelessness out there that we exist, whether we accept that it's matter, or it's antimatter, or it's transcendental, it's not material. Something is there that causes everything that doesn't have a cause. And these are the last six chapters of the Bhagavad Gita. And the whole point of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna describes in different places. For instance, he concludes the sixth chapter by saying, Yoginam api sarvesham. So he says, Yoginam api sarvesham. He says, of all the sarvesha, different types of yoga, Yoginam api sarvesham madgaten antaratmana shadavam bhajate yumam. He says, all of these yogis, they all have to perform bhajan. Kirtan, when it's done with devotion or with bhakti or with surrender, it's called bhajan. So when we talk about kirtan yoga, that's something that anyone can practice by repeating the mantra. When kirtan is actually enriched with devotion to the Supreme, then it actually becomes bhajan. The word bhaj means to worship. So it becomes an act of worship. It's no longer just a either impersonal or a mechanical activity, but it becomes an act of devotion. So he says, yoginam. He says, there's so many different types of yoga. So karma yoga, astanga yoga, hatha yoga. This all comes out in the category of dhyana yoga. And then there's bhakti yoga, and then there's Jnana Yoga. Yoginam api sarvesham madgatin taratatmana shvadavam bhajate yumam. He says those yogis who actually have shraddha, those yogis who have faith, they're actually the best. So faith, of course, everyone has some type of faith. just coming here entails a certain type of faith. Sitting in this room, we have faith that this is a well-built house and it's not going to collapse on our heads. It's just sort of implicit in the fact that we're here that we have faith. We get in our car, we have faith that we're getting in our destination. If we got in our car with the idea that we're going to have an accident, then we wouldn't come on our journey. We just stay at home. But rather we have that faith that, no, I'll get there safely. So we live by faith. Everyone has faith of one type or another. Our whole world is built upon faith. Sometimes the faith is wrong. We see that there are people who blow themselves and blow other people up on a matter of faith. That's called wrong faith. So you can have right faith and wrong faith. And then in the 17th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna talks about different types of faith. According to people's nature, there'll be different types of faith. Even animals have faith. A dog has a faith in his master. So there are different types of faith. But he says, Shradavam bhajate yo mam sami yukta tamo matama. Yukta uttama. And the yukta is just like yogi. The root of the two words is the same. So, but actually a person who has faith, he says, bhajate yo mam, who has faith in me as the supreme, and he adds that to his yoga, he is yukta. He is the most successful of all yogis. So this then becomes a repeated theme throughout the Bhagavad Gita. When Krishna talks about work, then ultimately he teaches us actually about karma yoga, but then ultimately he says, but work for me. When he talks about meditation and he talks about hatha yoga, then he says, but meditate on me. When he teaches us actually the science of philosophical speculation, then he says, Gyanavam amprapadyante vasudeva sarmiti. He says, yes, you speculate, but ultimately you need to come to the conclusion, vasudeva sarvamiti, that actually vasudeva means that the all-pervasive. He says, you have to come to the conclusion that I am actually the all-pervasive one through everything. And when he talks about bhakti, then he also says, bhaktya mama vijanati. He says the goal of bhakti or the purpose of bhakti is to know me. So ultimately we see that in Bhagavad Gita, when Krishna talks about different types of yoga, and he's the master of yoga, he's called Yogeshwar. In the end of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is called Yatra Yogitvara Krishna. Krishna is the Yogeshwar. He's the Ishvara, or the master, the controller of all yogis. So Krishna repeats that yoga actually has a particular purpose. And the purpose of whatever type of yoga that we're practicing is actually for to go through, as I mentioned earlier, different types of city, different types of stages. When we add kirtan to our yoga, for instance, kirtan is something that can be very nicely done along with hatha yoga. There's what's called yoga mishra bhakti. Mishra means mix. Sometimes you mix different types of yoga together. So when you have people practice yoga asanas, but with their yoga asanas, they mix devotion into their yoga asanas. And their meditation is, Krishna then says, but meditate on me, then becomes, because usually when we meditate, we need to fix our minds on something. So just like earlier, Krishna in the 6th chapter, he talks about actually how the airs of the body are balanced in the process of hatha yoga. He says, apani jivuti pranam, prana pranam patapari. So there's prana, all different, five major and five secondary airs of the body. So you need to balance those different types of airs. But in the process of achieving that type of equilibrium of the body and the mind, one needs to focus on something. So sometimes we focus on a sound, sometimes we focus on a light, sometimes we just focus on a thing. Krishna says, but focus on me. And when we focus on Krishna's form, then that becomes Yoga Mishra Bhakti. Or we may focus on the name when we're chanting a mantra, for instance, Om, Bhagavad Gita. I went on to Hungarian. In Bhagavad Gita, it says, Om Aksharad Brahma, Viharan Mam Anushmarad. He says that I am this Om, these sacred syllables, which is another mantra. It's another primordial mantra that's used in the Vedas. Generally, all mantras begin with Om. It's a offering of respect. So when you're saying Om, you're offering respect to the Supreme. The difference between Om and Kirtan is this, is that Om actually just represents, it's like a title, like you say Sir or Lord or Mister. Whereas when you do kirtan by chanting the names of the Supreme, then it's personal, because when you talk about someone's name, so Om refers to a position, a status, whereas chanting mantra refers to actually personally the name. So, or one meditates on Om, or one meditates on the mantra, and by doing that, one achieves the same. Similarly, those gyanis who also actually try to understand the world, the system of cause and effect, when they use the system of mantra meditation in order to further their goal, they're called Jnana Mishra Bhaktis. So their bhakti is, their gyan, their speculation is mixed with bhakti. So Bhagavad Gita ultimately shows that there are countless paths. Anyone who goes to a bookstore and goes to the part on yoga, then you have just shelf upon shelf upon shelf of yoga books. And so many different types of yogas are there. But where do all of these yogas come from? What is actually their cohesive purpose? What are they meant to achieve? So, as I mentioned, Bhagavad Gita actually gives the basic purpose of what yoga is all about, that ultimately, by yoga, we're meant to connect. We're meant to connect to the Supreme. For that, yoga is meant to teach us who we are. So this is one siddhi. This is one perfection of kirtan. We should know who we are. And Bhagavad Gita begins by knowing who we are. And Krishna therefore distinguishes between our bodies and ourselves. So this becomes the first lesson of Bhagavad Gita. This is the ABC. Know who you are. Generally, we're obliged and we're conditioned to actually identify ourselves with what we see in the mirror, with this body. I'm English, I'm male, I'm female, I'm 30, I'm 60, I'm 5 years old. We have so many different bodily identifications. And this is traditionally, and you've probably heard this word, this is traditionally called Maya or illusion. Maya means thinking something to be what it's not, mistaking one thing for another. When you mistake something, there are classical examples of this, for instance. When you mistake a rope for a snake, that's called illusion. It's a mistake. Because the rope isn't a snake, neither is the snake a rope, even though they may look like each other. Similarly, when we mistake ourselves for our clothes that we wear, that's also illusion. We're not these clothes. So this is our outer clothes, and this is our inner clothes. But this body is also just our clothes. Just like when I put my mitts on my hand, it moves just like my hand. But why does my hand move? What's making my hand move? What is actually that's causing that? I'm willing it to happen, and it happens. And when I don't will it, then it doesn't move. So what makes it move? I'm making a conscious effort to move my fingers. My fingers, do they know that they're moving? Yeah. My fingers don't know that they're moving. I know that my fingers are moving. But if my fingers don't know that they're moving, but I know that they're moving, who am I? But certainly not my fingers, because if I don't even know that I'm moving, then I can't be my fingers. And similarly for the rest of my body. So this becomes like the real basis of yoga, is that actually to be a practitioner of yoga, one starts by knowing that the body is actually a dress, a covering for our soul, for ourselves. We use this word soul. It's not such a good word in English, although it's better. In some languages, they don't have a word for soul. In Sanskrit, it's called atma, which is a little more perfect because it's called the self. So self is a better word. Soul is sort of a word, but it doesn't identify with us. When you say self, then it actually means me. So ourselves are what is within this body, and in order to actually really be proper practitioners of yoga, in which whatever of these yogas we practice, when we practice karma yoga, our senses are actually the main focus. When we practice meditation, then actually it becomes our mind is the focus with which we meditate. And when we're practicing jnana, then it's our intelligence, our intellect. All of these things are different coverings. None of them are actually ourself. I am intelligent. Well, I'm not so intelligent, but let's say I'm intelligent. I think, I feel, I have a body, I eat. So we're always using I as actually something which is the possessor of all of these things. But I don't say I'm the body, or I'm the finger, or I'm the intelligence. It's always mine. So it's sort of inherent, even linguistically, but when we say that it's my intelligence, whose intelligence is it? Well, whose mind is it? When I say it's my body, whose body is it? So this becomes the beginning, and all of these forms of yoga require, whatever yoga that we're practicing, require that we're very clear about who we are. Because when we're not clear about who we are, then we're really in trouble. And unfortunately, that's one of the reasons why our world is in trouble, because nowhere do we go to be educated in who we are. Everywhere we're taught as to what we should be, but not as to who we are. So Bhagavad Gita starts off with telling us who we actually are. Once you know who you are, you can determine who you want to be. And when you don't know who you are, but everyone tells you who you want to be, in 1984 language, that's called brainwashing. Because you haven't really had a choice to determine what you want to be until you really know who you are. So.